In 2008, Mark Tirsik made an abrupt career shift. He started the year as a managing director at Goldman Sachs, one of the nation's largest investment banks. By year's end, he was running the Nature Conservancy, one of the nation's largest environmental groups. It wasn't always a smooth transition. There have been episodes of culture shock, and his policies have raised eyebrows both inside the Conservancy and at other environmental groups. But Tirsik says he's trying to expand the environmental movement to make it more inclusive and more successful. Mark Tirsik is CEO of the Nature Conservancy, and he joins us now to talk about making the move from Wall Street to the green sector and his vision for the future of environmentalism. Welcome.
Hello there.
You can join our conversation by calling 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email. We're at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. We're also on Twitter, at Living Lab Radio. So, Mark, the day you found out that you were probably going to get the job of CEO for Nature Conservancy, there's a great story here. Apparently, you were so excited you actually crashed your car. What happened?
Yeah, an embarrassing story. Nobody got hurt. I backed my Jeep into a tree branch. The tree was fine. But, yeah, in that recent story, they teased me. They said I'm supposed to be a tree hugger, not a tree hitter. But anyway, I was excited. For me, this was an extraordinary opportunity. I've long been interested in the environmental movement. I was long an admirer of the Nature Conservancy. Obviously, environmental issues are today more important than ever, and to have the chance to join the organization as a leader was, of course, really exciting. So I guess I just backed up a little too aggressively, but all's well.
You are a very successful, still are, but you were a very successful man at this point. You were managing director at Goldman Sachs. You were one of 220 or so partners who'd received rather handsome payouts when Goldman Sachs went public in 1999. I mean, this was a bit of a jump off the rails for you to go from big finance to the Nature Conservancy. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, although I was raised as a city person, I grew up in the city of Cleveland and then spent most of my career in New York City and Tokyo. As I grew older and older, I became more and more interested in environmental issues. That really accelerated as a parent. My wife, Amy, and I made a real effort to get our kids to the outdoors. We spent a lot of time reading nature books, spending time with nature guides, and we became more and more interested in the wonders of nature, if you will, as well as the threats to nature. And I was a business person, so I also became very interested in business solutions to environmental challenges. And in fact, at the last part of my Goldman Sachs career, most of it, I was a mainstream finance guy, but my last couple of years, I led the firm's first environmental initiative, focused squarely on how can businesses and markets address environmental challenges. I got so enthusiastic about that, I wanted to kind of go all the way and join the environmental world full time. I'm just lucky it happened. It's been a very exciting four-year run for me. The Nature Conservancy, of course, is a 60-year-old organization. It was in great shape before I got here. It will be in great shape whenever I leave. But I do think, especially at this moment in time, adding even more of a markets orientation has been useful as we confront some of the big environmental challenges we face.
Well, let's talk about the work that you'd been doing at Goldman Sachs a little bit. You were played a key role, really, in developing the firm's environmental investments. I mean, what does that look like for a company like Goldman Sachs to be doing environmental investment?
Yeah, I should add, you know, I left Goldman Sachs in May 2008, so it's been a while. So I'm not really the right person to speak for the firm, but I had a great experience at the firm and worked with people I really respect, and for some 22 years was a mainstream finance person. And then I was contemplating leaving in 2005. I spoke with my boss at the time, Hank Paulson. He was the CEO of Goldman Sachs at the time and quite an engaged environmentalist. And so I looked to him for some advice. I said, Hank, I think I'm going to leave the firm and go into the environmental movement. And it was really Hank who had the idea. He said, instead, why don't you start an environmental effort for Goldman Sachs? At the time, so this is 2005, that was kind of an unusual idea. But we thought, as a firm that aspired to be a global leader and advisor on really important issues, then we ought to have an environmental strategy as well. And we, in particular, had the hypothesis that it ought to be good for the business at Goldman Sachs to have environmental strategies. So we were especially interested in those kind of win-win opportunities where the business would be strengthened and good environmental outcomes could be achieved. And, you know, today every leading financial institution has an effort like that. It's become quite common, and that's true across the corporate space all around the world. And I think it's great to have, as allies, people in the corporate space. Now, you mentioned in your intro to me that some people are critical of this, and it's true. Environmentalists now partner with companies that in the past were viewed as enemies to the environmental movement. So we need to be very careful as we move forward. But by and large, it seems to me, if we can harness market power, which is so powerful, to pursue environmentally positive outcomes, then we should do everything we can to try to make that happen.
Well, in coming to the Nature Conservancy, I mean, you personally took a bit of a pay cut, but also just in terms of the budget that you had to work with, I'm guessing, you know, Nature Conservancy brings in about $1 billion each year in income, and that far outstrips any other environmental nonprofit, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to Goldman Sachs. So
it's not really a fair comparison, I think. I mean, as an environmental organization, thanks mostly to the very great work of my colleagues and our very passionate and generous supporters, the Nature Conservancy has become a pretty formidable organization. Now, there are lots of great environmental organizations, and I've really got to know them all, and I respect them all. Organizations like NRDC, Environmental Defense Fund, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, you name it, Audubon, I can go on and on. They're all great, and they all have their own niches. There's kind of an ecosystem of environmental organizations. The Nature Conservancy, I think we're known for being nonpartisan, solutions-oriented, based in science, and that strategy has allowed us to become very big. And so we've got a big operating budget. We have a chapter in every state and now some 39 countries. We've got 60 years of experience. And so our size and our financial strength allows us to do some things that other organizations can't do. And so we're really pretty formidable. Just a couple of examples, or I'll just give you one to be brief, but shortly after I joined, we agreed to buy some 300,020, just a little more than 300,000 acres in northwest Montana. Beautiful wilderness. A place, in fact, where all the species that were there when Lewis and Clark explored are still there. Amazing. And really gorgeous. And this land was checkerboard land scattered around Glacier, the Swan Valley, otherwise already protected land. So protecting these last pieces of the jigsaw puzzle were really important. And so we had the chance to buy them in whole for a purchase price of $500 million, half $1 billion. And I really don't think any other organization could do it. You needed to have some real size and a little bit of a sense of, you know, financial daring to do that. And so we entered a deal to buy that land in August of 2008, right before the market crash. So it hasn't been an easy deal for us to manage our way through, but we're getting there. But anyone who visits Montana and sees this land that's protected now for perpetuity would think we've done the right thing. So the Nature Conservancy as an environmental organization has got some strengths, and from time to time we can put them to work in ways that really do help us achieve our mission. Our mission is to save the lands and waters that life depends on. And we take that very seriously, and the organization really does have the resources it needs to do that.
I mean, I think that's what Nature Conservancy has always really been known for, is this, I mean, what I would consider as an outsider anyway, to be basically a market-based solution. Buy the land that you want to protect. Then it's private land, and you control what happens on it, right? But I think in terms of what you're looking forward to doing in terms of kind of the new environmentalism, you want to go beyond that in terms of market solutions.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, it's really a great question, Heather. You know, let me add, if I can make a little plug, next Sunday, August 5th, I'm giving a talk at the Sconset Chapel in Nantucket. So for any listeners who will be in Nantucket, please come Sunday evening, 7:30. But that's what I'm going to talk about. So yeah, the Nature Conservancy grew really as the country's first land trust. And we spawned the land trust movement. And, yeah, in the good old days, we used to just buy things, and it's a pretty good way to protect things. The challenge for us, though, you know, we're a science-driven organization, and so as scientists, we look at the facts very clearly. And the facts tell us we have to scale up our work. So even though we've purchased quite a few pieces of land, and now we do marine and freshwater work, too, and policy work, and we even do very big deals like the one in Montana I mentioned, if you add up all our projects, and they're all great, it still seems to me a little bit insufficient to move the needle. The environmental challenges we face are so great. A way to think about that is, if you imagine all the things that we would like to see more of as environmentalists, say biodiversity, or healthy forests, or healthy coral reefs, or healthy fish stocks, all these things we care about, they're in decline. So we have to somehow achieve even more. And so, you know, we've become very big, we've invested a lot in land purchases, but we'll never be able to raise enough money to buy enough land to really save the planet. So land acquisition remains a core strategy, and it's a great one, but we want to do other things. And so there's so much to report on that front. Let me just give you one example. Some number of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, in the town of Quito, which is the capital city of Ecuador, a middle-income country, they were planning a new water filtration plant. So a pretty expensive investment in infrastructure to clean water for the citizens of Quito. Our local team said to the town water company, the mayor, and some business leaders, guess what? There's a lower cost way to secure the clean water you need. So their argument was an economic argument, not an environmental one. We said, if you invest in some upstream conservation, if you invest and pay farmers and ranchers to do things differently and help them understand how to better run their businesses so that they don't damage the water supply, that'll be a lower cost way to secure the clean water you need. So the Nature Conservancy chipped in some money. The local Coke company chipped in some money, Coca-Cola, the brewery, and the town water company. And we started this project, and lo and behold, it worked. You can test for water quality. So today, every water user in Quito pays a little fee for upstream conservation. Now, under the original plan, they would have paid a higher fee to pay for this new plant. But instead, today, they pay for upstream conservation. And so you have users of a service that nature provides, in this case, clean water, paying for conservation upstream. And it's this great win-win. We don't have to raise a lot of philanthropy to buy anything. Rather, people who need clean water, they have kind of an aha moment. They say, I get it. If I invest in taking care of nature, I'll get clean water. It's so elegant, that scheme. We now have 25 of these so-called water funds across Latin America. This will impact something like 50 million people. And this is conservation that pays for itself. So that's a different kind of strategy. And, of course, now that we have so much momentum in Latin America, we're exploring this all around the developing world. So those are the kinds of new strategies that we want to pursue. And they're great. They have financial advantages. And, of course, I'm oriented to that as a former financial guy. They also have kind of breakthrough in awareness advantages. Because what we see then is in jurisdiction after jurisdiction, people better understand why it is so important to protect nature. Sometimes I think we environmentalists blow it. We give folks the impression that nature is a luxury good, something to invest in when everything else is taken care of. But I believe very strongly that nature actually is the underpinning of human well-being, and we better get going and taking better care of our green infrastructure as opposed to man-made infrastructure. Does that make sense?
Oh, that absolutely makes sense. Yeah, and I think, but what you're talking about there sounds like the idea of environmental economics, if you will,
yeah.
Paying for buying the air that we use, buying the water that we use, has been around for a while. And I mean, in some ways, it sounds like what you're talking about is overhauling the economic system. How does one organization like the Nature Conservancy make a dent in that when this idea has been around for
right.
a few decades and certainly hasn't caught on like wildfire yet?
Right. Again, so a really good question. You're right. The intellectual side to what I just talked about has been well explored by academics and kind of intellectual thought leaders. So now it's a case of making it happen. And the Nature Conservancy certainly won't try to do this on its own. We partner with other organizations and governments and aid organizations, and now increasingly with the private sector, on virtually everything we do. So, it's kind of, we have a saying at the Nature Conservancy, all hands on earth. And so partnership is really important. But what we want to do is demonstrate to people how this can work. So demonstration is really important. That's why the water funds are so great, because the nature of watersheds is you can take care of a local environmental resource, a watershed, and capture that benefit locally too. For example, in Quito, that example I mentioned, the upstream area where we were protecting the watershed, it also was the Biocondor Reserve of Quito. So we would have wanted to protect it anyway. But then when we come to demonstration, this I think is a nice link to your question about our work with big companies. So it's true, I came to the Conservancy with the idea that we should really try hard to influence the behavior of companies with big environmental footprints, even if in the past we have not thought of them as friends of the environmental movement. Because my view is, at least in most cases, a company that is wiser about its environmental consequences will have a stronger business. And so if that thought is true kind of in an intellectual perspective, then it seems to me to make a lot of sense to actualize that as fast as possible and show the world. So that's what's happening in a lot of our work with big companies who, you know, are viewed a little bit with some skepticism by some of the environmental movement. But we don't mind that skepticism either. I think it's appropriate for some of our critical friends in the environmental community to keep a close eye on us, because this is new ground, and if we get something wrong, it'll be helpful to, you know, get our wrists slapped and get back in line. But I would say so far that work's going pretty well.
John is giving us a call from Orleans. John, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hello. Well, I certainly applaud the mission as stated by the gentleman of Nature Conservancy. However, I'm one of the skeptics. It's corporations that are the problem in raping the environment. If Nature Conservancy is really 100%, well, I'm sure it is pro environment, but why aren't you lobbying to get the laws changed so that corporate profit is not the overriding motive of corporations? Because corporations can be sued if that isn't their prime motive. And
because yeah, John, that is a great question. So thank you for asking it. I mean, the first response I'd like to make is you're absolutely correct in pointing to the need for organizations like ours to work hard with governments for the wisest and toughest and smartest environmental regulations and safeguards we can get. So we strongly agree there. And so not for a moment do I want to suggest our work with companies can take the place of good regulations. That would be wrong. So you're right about the regulatory front. So we have always had, and we continue to have, a big effort pushing for the best environmental safeguards we can. And even in this most recent period, the last couple of years, which has been a tough one on that front, there continues to be some good progress. And so we just have to keep up that good fight. But again, back to my little catchphrase, all hands on earth, think now of the business community. And so we do want good regulations overseeing how they behave and cracking down hard when companies misbehave. But if we can also help businesses understand that they can make proactive investments from a bottom-line perspective, because that's what motivates business, that will have good environmental outcomes, it seems to me we should try to do that too. Just so you know what I'm talking about, let me give you a couple of examples. We happen to work with a lot of beverage companies, so I'll just use Coca-Cola as one example, but I could say a similar thing about most of the beverage companies, the soft drink companies, the brewer, beer companies, et cetera. All of these companies, the big ones, do business all over the world. They obviously depend on good local water supply, and regrettably, we know with our science hats on that there will be, you know, increased episodes now of real water issues in different parts of the world. So wherever those water issues occur, a company like Coke is going to be, you know, directly engaged. And it's going to be important to the local community where that water issue is that Coke's seen as someone who's been a positive player in the water effort. And so Coke, you know, it wasn't very hard for Coke to understand, boy, we can't just be a taker of what nature's providing. We should be investing in nature, protecting watersheds, being smart about how we use water, using as little water as possible. When we return water to the ecosystem, returning it in the cleanest way and at the right temperature, because it's a transparent world, and if Coke doesn't do those things, it will face some risks. So Coke has partnered with organizations like the Nature Conservancy and many other good environmental organizations. And by the way, they disclose all of this stuff, so they're not pulling any fast ones, in my view. It's all science-based and well-disclosed. But it all adds up to being Coke. It all adds up for Coke and other players like Coke to being a pretty significant ally force in the environmental movement. And so we're just saying, gosh, we should take full advantage of that. Now, we're not naive. We know there will likely be other companies in that space who behave badly, and so we'll need good, tough governmental safeguards to keep them in line. We also know that some of these companies we're working with, you know, maybe they're trying to achieve a better PR reputation by working with us. Their motives aren't so pure. But we can test against that because, again, we're in the business of getting real things done in the real world that can be measured with science. And so I think we can protect ourselves there. And then finally, what excites me is, as you can just see in industry after industry, if a leader like Coke or Pepsi begins to make these kinds of investments, the other players in the industry pay attention, and they imitate them to some degree. So we don't mean to be naive. We agree there's a need for really tough safeguards. We really respect the environmental organizations who emphasize that role, too, keeping a critical eye on companies. But in the meantime, we want to do everything we can to, I mean, we need all the help we can get. So if we can get companies to be on our side, we want to try to do that to the max as well.
So you keep mentioning this idea that everything is science-based and you're measuring things with science. And I think conservation scientists, just by the title there, are kind of walking a fine line, right, between trying to maintain their objectivity in the science they're doing and yet having this overarching, in some ways, bias or agenda that they're trying to find the best way to save a resource or preserve
right.
a resource. When you add in this extra thing where now the scientists are also working with some of the companies that are potentially threatening those resources. I mean, have you ever talked to your scientists? Do you get a sense that they feel like they're kind of being pulled in a million different directions, or are they comfortable with this kind of juggling act, balancing act that they have
no,
to
do?
No,
there's not. There's a the way we try to handle that is to be as transparent and as open as we can. So again, I don't want to pretend that I'm not pounding the table saying no mistakes will be made. I'm simply pounding the table and saying we need to try everything we can to achieve our mission because, you know, although we're a great organization and have done great work, we're not really winning this war, so we need more help. So in our work with companies, an important part of the work is to, again, rely on our scientists as much as possible, publish the data as we go forward, and really welcome scrutiny and criticism from anyone who might provide it, so that if we do get something wrong, we'll know that as soon as possible, and we can step in and change behaviors. So an example here, a very controversial one, but I'll put it right on the table, is we have a very ambitious project with Dow Chemical that is underway. Yeah. Now, I'm pretty close to this project. I'm close to the management team at Dow, although I only met them in my Nature Conservancy role. And I think we're onto something very important here. Dow is trying to determine how they depend on nature, what that dependence is worth, because it's not on their balance sheets. Financial statements don't work like that. And if they're dependent on nature and that natural capital is vulnerable, what they might do to protect it. And I think if we can really crack the code here and help Dow be much smarter and sophisticated through their engineering talent about this, that's an important breakthrough. But of course, Dow's as a global chemical company, Dow's past track record is hardly pristine. And so when we began this project, there was lots of debate here at the Nature Conservancy and I think across the environmental world. Does this make sense? Now, I really think it does, but I don't want to say that it's risk-free. And so if there are folks who have criticisms out there or questions, again, we welcome that. We want to get it right. But here, you know, as the CEO here, when an opportunity like this comes up, we could be worried about these potential downsides and just ignore the opportunity. I think that would be irresponsible because, to me, it's really quite clear there is a big opportunity here, and it's our responsibility to pursue it and try to achieve it as best we can, even if it does pose some risks. I mean, our work is too hard. There's risks in everything we do, so we just have to face them openly and move forward as best we can.
Do you think that attitude is something that is more common in big business, in finance, perhaps a little bit more prone to taking risks and being more comfortable with risk than might have been present in the environmental movement elsewhere?
Well, a couple of observations. One, the environmental movement has always had innovators and risk takers. Now, the organization whose history I'm most familiar with, of course, is the Nature Conservancy. We're 60 years old, but my predecessors were not afraid of risk. You know, I mentioned we began as a U.S. land trust, but we weren't satisfied with that. We were a U.S.-based land trust, but my predecessor said, hey, we shouldn't just do land work. The issues are too complex. And so that got us into the water, you know, the freshwater and marine and policy worlds. And then my predecessor said, we shouldn't just work in the U.S. We've accumulated so much know-how in the U.S., we should become a global organization. And then we've had partnerships in the past at the Nature Conservancy that were viewed controversially. We've had a lot of success in Montana. I just mentioned our most recent deal, but over the course of our time in Montana, we've had a lot of success. But our initial, upon arrival, we were greeted in a kind of hostile way by the ranching community, who said, "Who are these environmentalists? Why do we need them here?" But then, as ranching patriarchs passed on, and ranching families wanted to keep their ranches in ranching, but they faced really tough tax issues, we brought conservation easements to Montana, and we've been very successful at keeping ranches at ranches, and the environmental outcomes have been very good, and ranchers are now our biggest supporters. I just mentioned that because my predecessors, I don't think, were ever afraid of risk. They rather focused on the mission and what's the best way to move forward. And so that's all we're trying to do. The other reaction I have to your comment is it's quite interesting to me how many business leaders are beginning to understand how important these environmental issues are, even in China. So we have a really great practice in China. And, of course, solving environmental challenges there is really important. And the challenges are severe. The country's been focused on lifting people out of poverty. They've made a lot of progress there, but it's been at the expense of really degrading their environment. But business leaders today are beginning to understand that they've got to do business differently. If you follow the news, you'll see Chinese citizens are now beginning to act up and take action when they don't like particular environmental initiatives by companies with bad environmental outcomes. And we have companies in China now whose business leaders are exploring with us the kinds of programs that we're pursuing with people like Coke. And that gives me encouragement. I think that's all upside. Not free of risk, but a lot of potential upside.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you so much for being here this morning. It's been an enjoyable conversation.
Thank you very much, Heather. Thanks for your interest. And let me add one thing to your listeners across Cape Cod. Thank you for all of your support of local conservation organizations. I'm most familiar with Nantucket. It's amazing. Almost half of Nantucket is protected, and that's an expensive place. But the island is in really good environmental shape due to great local organizations supported by the people of Nantucket. And my impression is that's true up and across the Cape. So thanks for all of your support.
Well, thanks again to you, Mark. Mark Turcek is the global CEO of the Nature Conservancy. You can find out more about the Nature Conservancy's work in New England and let us know what you think about Mark's vision for the future of environmentalism on our website. Go to capeandislands.org and click on Living Lab. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Tridle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.